Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. One of the great, great questions we have is taking care of our children and how we take care of our children. In the studio with me today is Randy Kaye. Now, Randy Kaye, who's been a radio host of her own, and she's a writer, has just finished a book called Ben Behind His Voices, which has to do with the illness of her son, how she discovered his schizophrenia, and how she helped manage it, and how the journey she had to take to find this. The book is fascinating. The book is for a lot of people who want to be able to understand their children's behaviors. Now, I can't tell you the number of times people have come to me and they told me about how their child was slightly odd. And then when I looked at it, there was a real disturbance. How do you catch it early? Perhaps we could learn something for this. Let me introduce you, Randy Kaye. Randy, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you so much, Armand.
Glad to have you here. So why don't you take us through the journey? You know this one well.
I do, and I'm still living it. Like one out of four families in this country, our family had to deal with mental illness. But it was many years before we realized what we were dealing with. I might have been one of these mothers coming to you and going, my kid's acting really strange. What could it be? And one of the primary issues about mental illness now is that even though research has changed the way we deal with things like cancer and heart disease so much because we can diagnose it before the heart attack and before stage three, it has not quite reached that with mental illness. I just heard a speaker from the National Institute of Mental Health talk about the fact that by the time we diagnose it, they're in psychosis, which is the equivalent of the heart attack or stage three cancer. So part of the reason I wrote this book is to chronicle the years.
Let's go back on that one.
Okay,
I know you've done that often enough. By the time we diagnose it, they're fully in it.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time.
Like we have warning signs, but we don't do anything about the warning signs. So by the time we get to paying attention to it, the crisis is already there.
That's right. And part of that is there's no definitive test. There are differences in the brains, in brain scans and things, but there's really no definitive test yet. You can't take a blood test and go, yep, schizophrenia. It is a fairly symptom-based diagnosis. So until those symptoms go into, the DSM, is the DSM-5 out now with the new, but, is this from column A and psychosis from column B, and the symptoms have to be there for 6 months, and then they go, yes, you have schizophrenia. So it's difficult to diagnose, but after my son was diagnosed, 5 years after some odd behaviors, I began to attend conferences about schizophrenia and learned from the psychiatrist who spoke there that gradual onset schizophrenia often follows a pattern that was so similar to what my son went through, which was a great, wonderful, bright, active child, always there behind his voices, hence the title of the book. At about mid-teens...
What do you mean behind his voices?
Well, when my son is actively psychotic, it's hard to find him there. He's very, very involved in his own world. If he has gone off his medication to this day, he is hard to reach. He's there underneath all that chaos, but I think of it kind of like if you had 20 channels turned on in your brain at once, it would be hard to kind of focus on the real world that is here. When you have 104 fever and you're kind of delirious and you don't know real from unreal, it's really hard to engage in what's really going on. And I feel like that is what it's like for my son.
It's not just about schizophrenia, because it's the same with all the other disorders that happen to people. They've got a manic depressive disorder, or in a real severe depression, or a hyperanxiety disorder, or a manic disorder. The person could get lost in their symptomatology. They can get lost, and you can't find them.
That's right.
You find a depressed child. You try to reach into that child, and that child is all the way down there in that world.
Somewhere. somewhere. You're right. And they're there, but it's hard to reach. Absolutely. And psychosis, I think, is psychosis. As I began to educate myself so that I could understand what was going on with my son and get out of hope, you know, I always have hope. But there are stages that families go through in understanding and dealing with a loved one's mental illness. And the first ones are what we call normalizing. And the whole first 100 pages of my book is about, this was wrong, oh, I'll fix it by doing tough love. Or
give me an example of that.
Okay.
Let's not just keep it to schizophrenia, because I know that this book is useful for just about anybody who's got a child with a disorder.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay, So give me an example of what are the signs that you would say, well, there's something, I'll just fix it.
Right. Okay. My son, when he entered high school, started getting very isolated. He started getting very anxious about school. He would come home and say to me, nobody likes me in that school. And yet he had a thriving social life outside of school. So who would think, oh, that's schizophrenia? I thought, okay, he's disorganized. He's not doing well academically. So he feels uncomfortable in this school. And so therefore he doesn't feel confident enough to make friends. He has friends outside of school, so I'm sure he's fine.
So if you were my neighbor,
mm-hmm.
and me being the mental health practitioner that I am, I would look at you and I say, that sounds funny.
Mm-hmm.
See, I would say that. But of course, as a parent, well, I'm going to bring you into this too, Linda, because I know you've been through similar things. As a parent, you say, I'll just fix it. Is that what you say to yourself? Let me get Linda Vidal in here. Just out of question. When you were going through this with your children, didn't you have similar questions?
Sure, sure. And I think that what happens oftentimes in adolescence, when you see certain behaviors such as this that you're responding, that you're remarking about, Randy, you would often say, well, is this normal? Because adolescence is so full of this question, this mystique.
Yes.
So it's oftentimes hard to know, is this serious enough to seek out professional assistance, or is it just a minor adjustment? Is it adolescence? Is it hormones? And so it's a difficult situation at that point.
Very difficult.
And there's a part of you, I'm sure, Randy, pardon me, that wants it to be okay.
Of course.
You don't want it to be a sickness. You don't want it to be an illness.
No, one of the hardest things and one of the hardest parts of the journey is learning enough to understand. And it didn't happen in those early couple of years because the symptoms, it's gradual onset. So the symptoms can look like ADD at first. I mean, it's very similar, the disorganization. It can look like depression. There were days when he seemed like he might be depressed. Then there can be OCD type behaviors, and then there can be extreme mood swings. But I had one psychiatrist say to me once, look, every adolescent is a little bit mentally ill, and it's hard to determine. And he meant it kind of as a joke, but it really isn't a joke. It's teenage years are tough. And I just kept thinking, wow, and we're just having a tough time. And of course, I would look at first to the things that I thought I could fix. My son's father deserted the family when my kids were 3 and 6. So of course, I thought it was psychological. Poor kid doesn't have a father. I've done my best, but he needs a father figure. And you look to try to fix what you can. And we were going for professional help. And by the time he was 16, and I said, you know, it seems kind of like depression to me. What I heard was, well, we can't medicate him. He's over 16, can't help him. So we'll just do talk therapy. And there are many different types of professionals, and some can recognize early symptoms and some can't. But the problem is, as you say, what parent wants to hear, well, your child has bipolar, or well, your child has schizophrenia? We don't want that future for our children. We want to think we can fix it with discipline, with love, with, you know, getting them the right professional help. So it is a difficult decision. And as my son began to get closer to really clear symptoms like psychosis, and I began to educate myself, the moment when I went, oh my God, he has a mental illness, was both a relief and terrifying, because who wants that future for their child?
Well, what does that mean? He has a mental illness.
It was still kind
of. You mean this is serious stuff?
This is serious stuff. Yeah, something's really
wrong.
It's like
your kid's got cancer.
That's
oh
right.
My God.
Yeah. To hear he's got an illness of the brain, and then to read the prognosis and say, "Wow, his life." You have to let. If you had a promising football star who had a car accident and couldn't walk anymore, you'd have to redefine your dreams for your child's future, and your child would have to redefine the dreams for his future. And parenting is loving and adjustment and all kinds of things. So to realize my child has an illness of the brain that will require treatment, at not just medical, but community and structure and positive thought, and it's not just all about medication. To realize that was to change my dreams of what my child's future would be.
It's actually change, Randy, of not only your dreams about what your child's life could be, it means it's a dedication to the rest of your life.
True.
Your life is done. That's it. I mean, enough of this easy going.
Mm-hmm.
You are now going to be a caretaker for somebody who is very seriously ill, and you can't take it easy anymore. Now, here you are alone, right? You have no dad around.
No, I have a husband now who's a wonderful stepfather.
Okay, but so yes. You got remarried, but at the time of the discovery?
Single parent.
Single parent.
And a daughter.
Single mother with a daughter. Child is diagnosed as having a severe mental illness, and it must have broken your heart.
Of course. Of course. I went and cried at my parents' graves like anybody else would. It's devastating to have that kind of a change, and yet, if I hadn't found education and support through NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, it would have been a very different journey. At least by that point, there were people and books and websites that I could turn to for information. And that at least empowered me. And when you say your life was done, that's a little strong because it's changed is how I like to look at it. Well, I have to tell you that right now my son is in college. Part-time, and part of that success is knowing that he can only handle part-time. Not me knowing that, but him knowing that. He's on the dean's list 5 semesters in a row. He just directed my husband and another actor in a scene from A View from the Bridge for a directing class. This is a child who is a little unique. You know, you think, oh, he should have been a hippie in the 60s. But while he's on his medication and has purpose and community in his life, he's doing very well in school, and he has a job, which he's holding on to. And that's miraculous. So I don't totally caretake him. Little by little, he is taking over management of his own life in small, manageable chunks. And one of the reasons I wrote this book was the journey through recovery, which always has the threat of relapse. And yes, success, my definition of success for my child is different than it was when he was 10. But there is hope.
My guest is Randy Kay. The book is Ben Behind His Voices. The reason for our program today is to say to you how many of you, your friend's cousin, your cousin's friends, you know, look down at your children, the children, and say, is there something wrong? And you don't really know. You can't really tell. So you have a child and you don't know, well, should I bring this child to a shrink? What's wrong with this child? I don't really know. Now you have somebody like Randy Kay. She wouldn't have settled. I mean, you could take one look at Randy and you know she's not going to settle for anything just being passive. She's not going to say, well, he'll grow out of it. The curiosity would be there, and hopefully, maybe this story would help many of you encourage other people where you see that there's a problem with the child. Because here comes one of those things, you know, the child is very popular and is doing really well in one place, but in another place he has a totally different life. Now, at that point, did your son have two worlds? What was the issue between why he was uncomfortable in school?
That's a very interesting question.
Did you ever see what that was about? Did he ever explain that to you?
I think part of the problem was he had gotten into this incredible, exclusive, private high school on a scholarship. And the pressure there was a lot. And he had gone through elementary school, and people would say he was ADD-ish. If we just handle him right, he'll get straight A's, which he did, because very, very bright. He went to high school where a lot of kids have this problem, especially with a learning disability or ADD, where suddenly you have to organize yourself, not his strength. So he didn't have a lot of confidence himself in the academic world, but in our Temple Youth Group is where he found a lot of friends. Then he found a girlfriend, and then things started getting, by the time his junior year of high school rolled around, he had gotten by the skin of his teeth, and then he just started, even that second world where he was popular, that was changing as well. They were kind of merging into this one world where he was lost in a lot of his own thoughts. And so Yeah, those two worlds, I think, had something to do with confidence and frustration about schoolwork and so on. But as he got older and dropped out of school 2 months shy of completing his junior year with a plan to wander around the country and dig ditches for money, I knew this was getting beyond the reasonable teenage quirkiness.
Well, why would some parents would say, you know, you got to let him find his own way and just let him out on his own. I mean,
yeah.
And other parents would say, no, you have to take control of it. What would be the difference there?
I always think that parenting, whether your child has a mental illness or not, is that balance between stepping in and letting go. And Linda's nodding her head, so I'm assuming, right? So it's always that balance. My parents had it with me when I was 40. It's like, what do we do to help her? So I went to tough love meetings. That's the first thing I did, because I had friends whose kids were acting out and running away, and they said, you can't come home without a written contract. I did all that, probably 80 times.
Could you describe what that is, please, to people?
Tough Love is an organization that I believe still exists. I'm not in touch with it now, but its theories are based on the fact that your child will learn his or her own lessons by natural consequences. So if you stop aiding them and enabling them and make it clear that if you want to be on my payroll in my house, these are the rules and you must follow them. If they decide to run away, let them run away and let them live on the street if they have to, and let them live with a friend if that's what they're choosing to do. And eventually they will come home and accept your rules. And for many people that works. But if your child, same thing with sometimes with addictions, straight addictions, if they hit bottom, they may realize they really need help. But with my son, he wasn't really learning from his lessons. And Tough Love, he would come home. We'd have a written contract, he would sign it, he'd be perfect for a week or two, and it would start all over again. And the last straw came when he was out in Idaho wandering homeless around there, because he had left a program I had sent him to there. And he was calling me every week, he was about 18 at the time, saying, Mom, there are psychic vampires here and all kinds of weird stuff, which I thought was drugs because he was smoking pot at the time. Finally, one psychiatrist said to me, if you're waiting for him to hit bottom, don't wait. Because if he has a mental illness, which I suspect, he'll hit bottom and he'll go, oh, it's pretty nice down here. And Tough Love isn't going to work here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Now, that's a big statement.
That was a big statement.
A pretty wise guy who told you that.
Mm-hmm.
Because most psychiatrists wouldn't say that. I mean, they would say don't let him hit bottom. But really, what you're saying is if he hits bottom, he may like it there.
Yeah.
Because fully crazy is not such a bad place to be, because you're fully crazy.
True.
But you're not on this planet.
That's not true.
You're not here.
And your mother misses you. And your sister misses you. And so, on the one hand, he would call me and say, I want to come home. And I was saying, fine, get a job, earn the money, and come home. That's what I was supposed to be doing, letting him learn from consequences. But NAMI has a saying, you can't reason with mental illness. And when someone is deep in their own world, that doesn't make sense to them. It makes sense to us, but it doesn't make sense to them. And I used to look at homeless people and go, well, get a job. I did. I had it tough. I got a job. Now I realize they can't see the world that way. It's a disease of connections. It's difficult to make those connections.
Let's talk about NAMI for a minute, since you introduced that. Go ahead, talk about that.
NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and it's...
How did you discover that, NAMI?
I found a brochure somewhere in my town, in the town hall or something. And I thought, well, I'll never need this, but I put it aside. And a couple of years later, when things were just, I was at my wit's end, not knowing what to do, I pulled that out and it said, this was created by families to help the families of people who might be dealing with mental illness. They have support groups. They have a lot of educational programs. And the first thing that I really experienced there was a course they have called Family to Family, which is free of charge. Any family member, if you have a parent, a child, a sibling, or a spouse with mental illness, or a cousin, or a friend, as you say, you can come and take this course. And in 12 weeks, it's not just a support group. The support kind of happens in between the education. But you learn about the various mental illnesses, how the brain works, how the medications work, what it might be like for your loved ones so that you can have empathy for what they're going through, how to communicate with your... I saw you had a flyer out there about communication skills. Well, my communication skills with my son were making things worse when I would just try to convince him he was sick, which I learned you can't do. The frontal lobe is impaired. anosognosia, I think is the name of it, and he wasn't aware. I still can't convince him he's sick, but I can make it a requirement to take medication, and that works just as well right now. So what NAMI taught me was the basic
facts.
Wait a minute,
how do you make it a requirement that he takes the medication? What if he just decides not to?
Then he goes in the hospital, and that has happened.
But who's controlling that? He's 26 years old. He's out there on his own. You know what I mean?
Well, he's not. Actually, I've been trying to let go a little bit at a time. And one of the hardest things I had to do in the year 2003, when he was finally diagnosed, he was hospitalized 5 times. And at the end of the 5th hospitalization, it was my job to let go of him completely so that he could get services. And I remember going in for the discharge meeting, and he was finally stable on a medication that really works for him. And the social worker says, can we discharge him to your home? And I said, no, he has no place to live. And my son looked at me, he was like, what? And I said, no, you'll have to find him a bed. And that was the hardest thing as a mother to do. But this social worker who ran that meeting, I will never forget her. Some of them just do things right. And after my son left, she said, okay, you know what? I have to congratulate you. You did a really hard thing, but you did the right thing. Do you know how many 45-year-old patients we have coming into this hospital who can't take care of themselves because their mother has always taken care of them? So congratulations. And I know that was hard. And she took my guilt away. So my son wound up in transitional living for a while. And
What is transitional living?
It's a place where they... It's like between the hospital and where you have an actual bed. And you stay there and you sleep there and they supervise your meds and they let you out at 8 o'clock in the morning and you're supposed to do something constructive and they let you back in at 5.
And is that something you're paying for?
At that point he was under state care. Hospital situation.
Okay.
And he could have been there 2 days, but it took them 5 months to find him a bed. Once they found him a bed and I did the paperwork to get him on Social Security disability and get some support for him. And then he became self-supporting with the help of disability. And he lived for 6 years, in a group home where he had freedom. He had a room, he had a bed, but they had chores. They had purpose. They had to cook meals for each other. They had a chore schedule. They had groups they had to attend. And in that 7 years, he ended up going back to school, not with me pushing him, but his decisions that he made. He was able to have community and purpose and structure in his life so that he could rebuild his life. And he stayed on medication. There were a couple of relapses. Every time he took his meds, he went off. So twice he went back in the hospital and rebalanced. But overall, in 7 years, he went back to the point where he was attending school. He was best man at my wedding 2 years ago. He was a groomsman at a sister's wedding, made a beautiful speech. He participates in family functions. We have him back. But he doesn't live with us. He has his own life. But it's a gradual
Have this thing about he either takes drugs or he goes into the hospital. Who has control over that?
At the group home, it was a requirement that you have supervised medication, and that requirement comes from your psychiatrist.
So he has a psychiatrist that he has to report to.
Right.
And if he reports to that psychiatrist and the psychiatrist says, oops, you're off your meds, get into the hospital, I mean, what's going to make him go? Why doesn't he just run away?
He could run away. Every state has different rules about involuntary commitment, and sometimes if you're brought in by the police in handcuffs, then you get 72 hours. There's a doctor named Javier Amador who wrote a book called I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help, and I've taken a training with him and spoken to him quite a lot, and he says that he had a brother, Henry, with schizophrenia who never believed he had it but took his meds, and he says you'll have a better chance of encouraging someone to take their meds on the strength of your relationship rather than on the strength of you have an illness, you must take it. So my son loves to spend time with us, with the family, and I just very calmly, like you would with a 12-year-old, say, great, we'd love to have you stay with us. Here are the rules. We're going to, your psychiatrist says, I have to watch you take your meds, and so we're going to do that morning and evening. And he wants to stay with us, so he goes, okay, Mom.
So there is a blend of tough love in there. It's not, yep. you know you've got to have firm boundaries.
True.
And to my understanding, the best way that a parent can help deal with their child is to understand the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And when the boundaries get pushed, to be able to not, just bend automatically, because that's where it happens. I think part of what makes a kid feel safer is knowing that their parent has some reality. You know, if I'm sliding into a deep depression and I'm a child, and I go to my parent and say, I want to stay home from school today, and I'm going to make rules, oh, I have a cold. Sometimes I really wish I'd have a mother who would say, get up and get out there. You're not staying home from school today. Mm-hmm. Because the boundaries and limits are set. And there's a certain set of safety, a certain feeling of safety you get when you know your parents have boundaries. Not just restrictions, not just limitations. So did you find your boundaries were always being pushed and tested in some way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of the process is being willing, and this is if your child has a mental illness or no, being willing to, if you say you're going to do this, then do this. If I say, well, run away, I had to be willing to open the door and let him run away. And there are times now if, you know, there's natural consequences in his life. I think we all need the safety of boundaries. We all do for some extent. Very few people I know with no structure in their life can self-structure. I mean, look at people who just retired and have nothing to do. So my son really, really responds well to structure, especially if he has the illusion and the dignity of feeling like he had some say in creating that structure. For instance, since my son just had a relapse because they took all his services away, and now he's back out again and we're recreating those services, and he used to be able to take his meds at night before he went to bed. Now I say, you got to take them between 8 and 10. That's it, between 8 and 10. And life is so much easier because I don't get this, Mom, can 5 more minutes? You know, I don't get that anymore. And there's a safety in that. And I don't say, because you're sick. I say, because that's the rule. That's a really good parenting trick, whether you've got a 12-year-old with a curfew or whether you've got a child with schizophrenia who's visiting you for a week. I simply say, if you want to do that, you have to stay here. And there were periods during his recovery where I knew he wasn't taking his meds, and he'd come to visit us. And, you know, you learn to see the symptoms, and I would say to him, got to take you home. And he'd go, well, why? I said, because you're making me uncomfortable. It's that eye language. I feel uncomfortable right now.
What about that eye language? It's mm-hmm. a very important thing for us to teach. In fact, we're going to have to take a short break soon. And when we come back, that's one of the things I want to talk about, because one of the most difficult things is for a child to hear that things are for their benefit, when it's really for the benefit of the parent. You know, the parent is saying, this is for your good, it's for your good, it's for your good. But I think it's so much nicer when a parent says, this is for my good. And this is my shop. And the reason I want to do this is because it makes me feel better. When I come back, I also want to talk with what it's like to be the parent of somebody who gets diagnosed with a severe illness as well, you know, physical illness. We're going to talk about that, if that's okay with you, Linda, because
sure.
that's kind of amazing as well. This is Armand DeBille with you with The Positive Mind. The name of the book, Ben, Behind His Voices. One family's journey from the chaos of schizophrenia to hope, and it's what it's like to have a child that you really love and care about who shows up with mental illness. This was a serious mental illness, but very often for children, it's not as serious at the beginning, and you don't see the steps, and you don't understand that what this child is going through is not regular stuff. And one of the ways that I was trained as a therapist is, it just sounds funny. That's what they would say. It just sounds funny. What the child is saying, it just sounds funny. It doesn't exactly make sense. It almost makes sense, but it sounds funny. And as a parent, you have to trust that voice. You have to trust that voice. It just doesn't sound right. Let me just dig a little further into this without being aggressive, still being loving, but maybe trying to find some way that I could get to the fact that maybe my child needs help. And I have to find a way to do that. Because many people, they don't know. They don't know. They don't want to pay attention. They don't want to go through the risk of it. They don't want to, have to deal with this. But you do. So we'll be right back with you in a couple of minutes, my friends. We're going to go further into this, you and possible attention that you could pay to your children if something is wrong. Remember, NAMI, N-A-M-I, which is National Alliance
on Mental Illness.
On Mental Illness. N-A-I-M-I?
N-A-M-I.
N-A-M-I. N-A-M-I. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. That's a little bit of Chopin, Vladimir Ashkenazy, doing the Chopin Waltz in B minor, Opus 69. So we're here with a little grace, talking about children. And when a parent begins to see the signs, you know, it's not just with your child, because this also happens with mates. I've seen this happen with husbands, boyfriends, girlfriends. You know, sometimes people are just going funny, and they're getting deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And it may not be a full illness. Like, for example, let's just talk about for a moment how many different illnesses that you've learned about with parents have to deal with, because it's not only with the parents. Sometimes it's with your husband or your wife as well. My guest, of course, Randy Kay. Randy, let's talk about it. What did you learn about?
Okay. Well, you know, in my taking the family to family course and teaching it, there are a lot of the people who take the class are parents because they feel like they can still help their child. But in the class, I've had spouses who are dealing with their husband or wife who was supposed to be their life partner who are incapacitated by mental illness. And by mental illness, it doesn't mean just schizophrenia, which is the thought disorder, but it can be any of the mood disorders, such as bipolar disorder, which a lot of celebrities are coming out and talking about now. Major depression. There are many kinds of bipolar. People showing anxiety disorders, OCD, PTSD is a big one that you're dealing with now, especially with the veterans coming back, hopefully coming back from Afghanistan. And many vets have PTSD in their spouses and their parents, and their children have to deal with the instability of someone who's dealing with...
No, we're throwing these words at people. So now I want to try something different.
Okay.
It's great. So, Randy Kay, I mean, you're pretty darn good and pretty knowledgeable, and you have a lot of information. So give us your understanding, instead of my professional understanding. What's your understanding of these illnesses? So what is a borderline condition?
Okay.
From what you understand?
Borderline personality disorder, as I understand it, from the parents that I've taught in
these
classes.
Okay, so now we're not going to have to do any more... defending this, okay? Let's just say, what is borderline personality? You give me the answer because you know.
It's one of the mood disorders, and I know one of the symptoms of it that is most disturbing is you just never know what to expect from their personality, and often they will do things that are violent. The illnesses, the lines are blurry.
Okay, but wait, so we talk about borderline, we talk about one sign is rage, lots of rage
lots
that
of
appears,
rage. Right.
Unpredictability, and a pushing of the boundaries, always a pushing of the boundaries, okay?
Yes.
So you have a child who does this, or you have a parent who does this, or you have a mate who does this.
Or a sibling.
Or a sibling, and you ask yourself, are they mean or are they crazy?
Exactly.
And say, hey, wait a minute now. This may be pressure on them. Okay, so what other disorders?
Sure.
Let's talk about bipolarity, and you talk about the many different manifestations of it.
Well, bipolar is what they used to call manic depressive. And again, there's rapid cycling and slow cycling. But either you're lost in the throes of a deep depression and you can't get out of bed and it's all the symptoms of life is worth nothing or suicidal ideology or actual actions. And then you can maybe go through a period where you're charming for a while. At least I say bipolar people get to be charming part of the time. And then you can swing into mania where you don't sleep for 2-3 days at a time and you go out and buy 3 new cars. Or I know someone whose child would just work for a while and then go into mania, take a credit rating, get on a plane and fly to a foreign country and get lost. I mean, there are just all kinds of, when you swing into mania, there may be psychosis in there as well. And they just do unpredictable things, great grandiose plans that make no sense.
And they look like happy-go-lucky people. But there's something about a manic person that you could, they just look funny.
Yeah.
It's just funny. It's like, you know, it's a heightened sense of well-being. It's so well-being that it's, again, there we go. It just doesn't look right.
Gets out of
person's
that reasonable.
Too happy.
Right. It gets out of that reasonable area. And it almost looks like they're high on drugs. But there may be no drugs involved at all. It's simply their mood swings getting into this area of unreasonableness where, you know, they may blow all their money, max out their credit cards and more, or they may go into psychosis where they want to direct traffic naked on a street corner thinking that's a great thing to do. It seems like a good idea at the time. So mania can be very frightening in the extreme lows and the extreme highs.
And one of the most difficult people to ever bring to for help.
Yeah.
Because they feel good.
They do.
In fact, it feels terrific. Yeah. Media feels great. You know, if it could last and if it would work, it wouldn't be such a bad thing.
Especially at the beginning stages.
At the beginning stages.
And I think part of psychosis is you get this feeling that you can do anything. And who wouldn't miss that if it was taken away? I remember seeing a special on TV once and somebody with bipolar was stable on medication and he said, you know, my life is better. I get along better with my family. I can keep a job. It's all good, but I sure do miss being God.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, well, all right, that sums it up, because in that mania, you can do anything. And that can be very addictive, just wanting to be in that place again, but then comes the crash. And then there's depression, where it's like all crash and no mania. So,
But separate than from the bipolar.
It's a unipolar.
There's this one depression that's just so bad the person never comes out of it.
No, and you want to
How do you distinguish between the bipolar depression and a regular depression?
I think if it doesn't swing into mania, then it's regular depression. A lot of these are diagnosed symptomatically.
I know. I'm just getting it from you the way that you've taught you and shown you, and I'm kind of proud that you've been able to pick up this information. What other things do you see? You know, let's say you see somebody who's – when do you distinguish that it's schizophrenia as opposed to just like a personality disorder? Like, let's say paranoia, for example.
Okay.
Right? There's somebody who's talking about they're out to get me, they hate me, they hate me, they hate me. When does it go off the edge? When does it go to the very serious?
I think when the symptoms begin to interfere with your reality and your life.
Okay.
You know, the thing is, we all have periods where we're like, look, I get out of my car, I'll say it on the radio, I tap my car twice when I get out. Because, I don't know, every time I've done that, my cars have lasted to 300,000 miles. So it's a little harmless superstition. But if I forget to do it, I'm not leaving the mall to go back and tap my car twice. So it's not interfering with my life. We all have times like, you know, when the light turns green and we go, oh, the universe is with me. That may be true, but when you carry it to the point where you think if a car blinks their headlights, then the universe is giving you a message, that's interfering with your real life reality. And there's that degree of, okay, is it just a little cute quirkiness, or is it really interfering with being able to love and live and work and all those things that ground us in life? That's where the line is, I think.
And that's just with about anybody. Now, if you have a partner, or the people you've seen, if they have a partner who's got this, who's got any of these illnesses, like they're bipolar or something, and the partner wants to take care of them, but the partner can't. You know, what do they do? I mean, how do you take care of somebody who's yelling at you and screaming at you and hates you all the time?
Sometimes you can't, especially if it's your spouse. As a parent, I feel like still I have an element of control, but I've had people in my classes who say, I just have to leave the house because you can't really fix them. Sometimes all you can do is take care of yourself. And even as a parent, sometimes all I can do is take care of myself and my daughter and let my son go into the hospital, because that was the consequence. So with a spouse, I had one woman who said, you know, I had she was a little 5-foot thing and she had three young kids and her husband was in a manic phase and he was just kind of wandering the streets and it was Christmas and she said, I had to dress up like Santa Claus and walk down the stairs and be Christmas to my children because my partner wasn't there. And how do you tell your partner it's a requirement that you take medication? You can't really do it. It's not the same dynamic as with a parent. And when I think of children growing up with parents who are unstable due to mental illness, it's not the same as dealing with Alzheimer's when you're already a grown-up and suddenly you're losing that parent. It's growing up without the stability of a parent who can give you the love that you wanted.
You'd think that that's what normalcy is.
That's right.
See, I knew people who grew up in violent environments, violent, and they were beaten by their parents, but then they were beaten by everybody.
Right.
Then, you know, the priests beat them and the camp counselors beat them and everybody, and they said, well, that's the way the world is. You get beaten by people.
Yeah.
That's the way the world, that's reality.
It's your reality, and you kind of attract it sometimes. Yeah,
and then
it's familiar.
So when you wind up in a place where nobody's beating you, sometimes you create it. Because that's what normalcy is. The same thing with love.
That's right.
People who have distorted images of what love is from parents who may be mentally challenged, they can only go and try to repeat that same pattern by finding somebody who will love them the same way.
Mm-hmm. Until they're aware of it.
Yeah. Now, it's very hard. Of course, you have a spouse, you know, and you're dedicated to your spouse, and you make a promise come health and fire and water and whatever happens, I'll be there for you. Mm-hmm. And then they get sick, and you say, that's it, I've had it. I'm out of here.
It's tough.
It's a very tough thing.
Especially when you feel you have children to protect. I mean,
that may be the crossover. You see, yeah. If you have children to protect, that may be your way out. But I wonder, if you love somebody and they get sick and they really have this deep illness, they fall into like a manic depression or a deep depression, how do you walk away from them? How do you do it? How do you do it? I mean, it's just got to be, in your face to the point where you can't handle it anymore.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Very difficult.
I have no answer to that. I know that my first husband, the father of my children, was an alcoholic. And even though I rack my brain, I don't see a mental illness in any of his symptoms. But there was a point where I knew if he got really drunk and left us that we were better off. And yet I had two brokenhearted children who missed the good side. You know, so when you think of a spouse and you're protecting your children and then you take your children and you leave, then the children still miss the other parent because that's their normalcy of love. So it's very difficult. The courage of families facing mental illness is huge. And many of them are, what I find is when I go and speak about this, even if I'm talking about stress relief or the voiceover business or the other things that I do, if I happen to mention this, because to me it's a fact of life. If I had a child with a physical illness, I would talk about it. So I have a child with a mental illness, I talk about it. It's a fact. But inevitably someone comes up to me in the hall and says, thank you for being open about that. My husband, wife, aunt, whatever, we've never spoken about it in our family. We've hidden in a closet. And the stigma associated with having a family member with a mental illness is what holds so many people back and parents from getting the help or the professional opinion they need when their child's behaviors are just getting beyond weird, beyond weird.
And you mentioned one other fact. You also have a daughter.
Yes, I do.
So what did you have to deal with your daughter when you were dealing with your son?
Oh, my darling daughter. With her heartbreak, with her confusion. She is his younger sister.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, she looked up to him with such admiration. They got along great. And then she was about 12 and he was about 15 and he started acting a little weird and she was kind of embarrassed. And then by the time he was 17, people went, oh, that's your brother. And she would just roll her eyes. And then the chaos in our house until I learned to not make things worse by communicating, like trying to convince him of things and not using eye language. Until I learned the communication skills, we had a house with a lot of arguing. And it was at that point that I had to look out for my other daughter. This sibling often gets lost mm-hmm. in the chaos of what the ill child is going through. And when I sent Ben to a troubled teen program, I had almost a year with my daughter where it could just be me and her. And it could be all about her. And that really helped her. And when she's ready, she's now married and happy, and she loves, loves, loves her brother. But she has accepted the loss of a big brother and a new little brother that she has to kind of look out for. And she's made that journey. It's a little different journey, but there is that law. I mean, siblings, I have chapter guideposts in the book that address the issues that come up in each chapter, and I talk about the siblings. They may have survivor's guilt. She says to me, are my kids going to have schizophrenia? Does it run in the family? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of fears in the siblings of one, whether they have a physical or a mental illness. It's kind of a what about me or what's going to happen to me? And then they miss their sibling. They're scared. They love their sibling. And so there's a lot of issues in there as well.
Randy, you talked about the eye language. And I'm wondering if I don't get to the thing about on this program, I want to do it on another program because it's remarkable. So my apology for that. But Randy, you talk about the I language as mm-hmm. opposed to the you language. Tell me what you learned.
I learned that if I stopped accusing my son and saying, you're doing this and you're doing that and you're doing this wrong, if I just started to speak about myself or speak about the rules as a neutral territory, I'm uncomfortable, so therefore I'm going to take you home. Work better than you're acting weird, so you have to go home. It's just a very different dynamic. You have to phrase it so it's realistic. Like if I say, you know, when you do that, it makes me uncomfortable. My son would go, don't use that psychological talk on me. So they're very smart and they see through it. But really, I would just say I learned two skills. One was using I language and just saying, this is how it affects me. So for my comfort, I'm going to take you home to your group home right now. But. That's how I feel. And I would just keep bringing it back to me. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I need
that's
to do right now.
That's the essence of it. The essence of it is maybe I'm wrong, but this is what I want.
Right.
And because I'm the biggest person around here, this is what I want. This is the way I'm going to do it. And I'm not doing it, but it's not for your benefit. It's for my benefit.
Right.
Because I want to stick around here as your parent. And I'm not going to feel good unless we do it my way.
Yep. And that's a huge thing because they can't argue with that. You know, and when I stopped trying to be right and just said, this is what I need, because if that's what you need, it's not right or wrong. It's what you need. So that really helped me to not get into locking horns with my son about whether he was sick or wasn't sick. I just said, this is what I require for you to be here. So that helped a lot.
Randy, just in our closing minutes, I could imagine when you're dealing with a thing like this, there are many times that you have to spend on your own weeping in your room.
Red lights are big.
Tell me
that.
About that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What do you mean red lights are big?
I cry at the red lights. When each of my parents died, he'd like stiff upper lip at the funeral. And then grief hits you when it hits you. And sometimes stopping at a red light and you have 30 seconds to not think and the tears will come. I never force the pain. The pain will hit me when it hits me. And recently, my son had a relapse, which terrified me. And thank God he's come out of it and he's back to being really successful at the moment. But when he went back in, I went through the motions like we all do this. But then I'd sit alone at my desk and suddenly I'd start to cry. And I think we have to cry. And then we all need a little pity party once in a while. That's my theory. And then when it's over, you move on.
You cry at red lights.
Sure.
And you cry in your car. Mm-hmm. And your parents died when?
My parents died my mother about 18 years ago and my dad about 16 years ago while my kids were pretty young.
And how long do you have your car?
Well, I cried in the other car before this one. I've only had this car 11 years, so.
So when you tap it twice, maybe you just one tap for each parent.
I like that.
You like
okay,
that? Right?
Sure, absolutely. Sure, one for each kid, either way.
One for each kid. Well, it's been a very difficult time, and I know so many people who go through this with their children, and I think you're making a real contribution, Randy Kay, by having written a book about this, because I think it helps people. Now, NAMI, if people want to get in touch with NAMI, what do they do? What's the best way to do it?
The best way to do it, now, every state has an affiliate, and that includes Alaska and Hawaii, and I think other various islands around, but Canada has their own organization as well. But it's NAMI.org, NAMI.org. We'll get you to the national NAMI site. You'll find information on there. You'll find all kinds of articles and links to each state's affiliate. And on each state's affiliate, you'll find educational programs for the family, for providers. They have a peer mentoring program. They have a program called In Our Own Voice, where people who are in recovery from mental illness and doing well will come and speak to you. So there's a lot of wonderful programs. There's also crisis intervention team training for police officers. So NAMI is a great resource. The book's website is benbehindhisvoices.com. It isn't officially published till September 15th, but it's at Amazon right now, so people who ordered it are getting it. But NAMI.org is, if you're struggling with this, and again, one in four families in the country is, that's a really good place to start because it links to other excellent, excellent resources. And here's what I feel families need. When mental illness strikes, I call it search. They need support, and we're afraid of that because of stigma. E for education, A for acceptance. I just say it is what it is. I don't like it, but it is what it is. R is for resilience and maybe respect. C for communication skills, and H for humor and hope. Both of those things. And that helped me, and by helping me, I could help my son.
Wow. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Randy Kay. Randy Kay, the name of the book, Ben Behind His Voices. This is Armand DeBoe with you with The Positive Mind. This program was pre-recorded, so we're playing it to you. But if you do want to get a copy of it and you want to hear it, you can go to thepositivemind.com on WBAI, or you can go to WBAI.org We will be back with you soon, my friends. I want to thank you very much. It's kind of remarkable what people go through in the name of love. And it's so beautiful that they do it as well. I'm so glad we have people around on our team who are just, who are heartfelt. Randy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.